David and I are going to sit down and take some of your questions and have a little discussion. So I've got some prepared questions here, David. The first one is about the fact that we're in a university. And in your book, academics don't always come off so well-regarded. So here in this academic setting, what can you tell us to change the mind of intellectuals?
Well, that's a little awkward. I think I would begin by saying that I'm pretty much an equal opportunity offender. I don't think there's probably any single constituency in the book that gets off all that well, including my own side, which is messed up comprehensively. But that's what doing real work in the world is like. It's not pretty. But here's what I'd say. I started with the medical analogy. And in medicine, there are all of the following things. There are people who do theory. There are people who do pure research. There are people who do applied research. There are people who do what doctors call clinical practice. They actually work with individual and community patients. And because of the way medicine works, all of those different parts respect each other. You would never hear an AIDS treatment practitioner saying, oh, those guys off there doing virology, they're idiots, right? They know that they need each other, and the pure researcher is every bit as respectful of the frontline people. In criminal justice and more generally in the social sciences, that's a lot less true than it should be. And there's a bias among people who are serious academic researchers that getting too close to practice can be dangerous. It's kind of contaminating. It can be déclassé. You don't want to go native. You don't want to be contaminated. And it ends up meaning that they're not as plugged into the real-world needs of the frontline people. They don't get to learn from them, which you can learn a lot from them. And there's often a feeling among people doing the work that those people over there are academic in the pejorative sense, meaning they're not practical, they don't have anything to offer, it's all silly. And if we had relationships between pure researchers and applied researchers and practitioners on these issues that felt more like medicine than what we're used to, we'd be a lot better off.
Well, also in the audience, we have a mix of political people and law enforcement officers. So can you talk to us about the problems and solutions to getting these stakeholders on board with this program?
Well, I'll tell you that 20 years of results helps a lot. So there have been very different answers to those questions at different stages in this process. So I spend a lot less time on this than I might otherwise because I've been trying to develop these more kind of first principles ideas. But the fact is, the first application of this approach was in Boston in 1996. And it generated this, we now understand, a 50% reduction in homicide across the city, a two-thirds reduction in youth homicide. It was so dramatic, so fast, that the press called it the Boston Miracle. It was amazing. And we then tried to take it elsewhere and see if it would work in other places. And basically what we found ourselves doing was saying in other cities, the way you fight serious violent crime is by sitting the most dangerous people in your city down and telling them to stop it. And you can imagine how well that went over. It was ridiculous. I mean, I still have these vivid memories of sitting there saying this to mayors and police chiefs and community people and listening to the words coming out of my mouth, and I knew why I was saying them. I knew what the theory was. I knew what the research said. I knew it had worked in at least one place. And even I couldn't quite believe it. It was nonsensical. Fortunately, it turns out it is right. You know, it's not just telling them to stop, but this stuff really does work. And there is now a long, long, long history of it. And it now means that people have grown up with it, they're familiar with it, they've seen it other places, they've talked to their friends in other cities. And it's just not as hard as it used to be. And I don't think there's anything except putting all that time in that would have made that difference. So again, this is a university setting. People here might have read one of the seminal pieces of the philosophy of science, which is Thomas Kuhn's The Structure of Scientific Revolution, which says, it's kind of a study of the sociology of science, and it says, science doesn't happen the way we think it does because people have had hypotheses and they've been tested and the results have said the hypothesis is wrong and this other one is supported. And so scientists who spent their entire careers believing one thing, see one experiment and change their minds, people don't do that. What Kuhn found was that scientific ideas change basically because the last generation dies and the new generation comes along and takes over. So all of you out there, you are in fact much more the future of America than you think, because the rest of us aren't going to last very long.
So now here's another one that I think can resonate with some of my colleagues in the university. Many people are of the opinion that crime should be fought by remedying the root causes, income inequality, poor education, etc. Are these root causes real? And if so, how can they be addressed? And how does that interface with your approach?
So root causes, the way people have traditionally thought about them, are things like racism and bad economies and lack of equal economic opportunity and bad schools and official neglect and bad health care and sort of that suite of things. Now that we know some of what we know, as I've just shown you, I believe that we ought to add at least one root cause to that list, and that is mass incarceration. We are actively harming these neighborhoods in the name of protecting them by saturating them with jail and prison and criminal records. If we stop doing that, it would not fix things. It's just something that is now making things worse. And I was both by, I think, nurture and inclination and training a root causer. And that didn't survive the first 5 minutes that I walked a Watts crack market in 1985, because the idea that in this situation where there were buildings taking gunshots and corner boys with guns owning the streets and the black grandmothers literally barricaded in their apartments because they were so scared of the young men, when all of that was going on, and I would add the idiot white folks from out of town who were out of town, out of the neighborhood, who were driving in to buy their drugs and do all this damage and then drive right back out to their quiet suburban neighborhoods. The idea that when that is the reality, you can fix the schools and bring in investment and get people to buy homes and maintain their properties. I mean, these were kids who were not going to school because they didn't want to walk through gang territory. So the idea that you could fix that by working on core social conditions was ridiculous, because you can't do anything in that environment. And it turned my thinking on this exactly on its head. It was that, you know, it's in the founding documents, right? We promised the country domestic tranquility, and we are not providing that in these neighborhoods. And until they have domestic tranquility, they will never be able to work on schools and family support and economic development. You won't get a supermarket to locate in this neighborhood when people are afraid to go outside. So first we need to provide for the fundamental public safety, and then we can work on the rest of it.
And that's exactly why, you know, we turn to this issue in relationship to our engagement with the educational pipeline in our county. We recognize that these external forces can preempt any efforts that we could make in improving educational success for our students if kids are trouble getting to school. This one question here, I think the answer is yes, but let me just double check with you. This program is being utilized in Salinas currently, and we have our chief of police.
Chief McMillan?
Yes. Can you tell us? This is the chief of police of Salinas.
That's my recollection, yeah.
Homicides?
Yep.
2011, that trend continued downward. The funding ran out. To be perfectly frank, the executive leadership of the police department was not fully engaged in this. When the money ran out, the strategy ended, and our numbers came right back to our second.
Wow. Hold on. Yeah, okay. So we came back to the second highest number of homicides we had last year in our history. So today we are, with really a lot of David's help, the work he's been doing, reinstituting the ceasefire strategy in Salinas, a group violence reduction strategy. It has not been on the street yet because it has to be built out in a very specific way. And that first begins with getting our own house in order. And so for the last year, we've been engaged in standing up a rigorous internal intelligence analysis process that is very clearly defining who those very few but very dangerous young men are in Salinas. We are targeting them for rigorous intervention while strategically trying to avoid the people who aren't involved in this stuff, because we do recognize that when we miss, when we grab the wrong kid and ask him if they're a gangster, we do tremendous community harm. So that process is currently being worked through right now. And then the other part that I would like to add in getting our own house in order is that we've just, in fact, Monday will be the last class. It will mark 100% of Salinas police officers being trained in police legitimacy and procedural justice that David's been talking about. I'm proud to say that the Salinas Police Department is the, thank you. The Salinas Police Department is the first police department on the West Coast to go top to bottom in training police officers in police legitimacy. We're doing it with our colleagues in Oakland and Stockton and with tremendous support from Superintendent Gary McCarthy at the Chicago Police Department and his academy staff. So yes, we're doing it. No, you have not seen a lot of it publicly. And frankly, nor will you, because this isn't something that should be done very, very publicly. These are honest conversations we have with these young men. That communication piece is the next part to roll out, the call-ins, the custom notifications. We have deep connections with our community partners and the faith community that are going to help us with that. So that's a real long way of saying, yeah, we're doing it.
Thank you. Well, we're getting a lot of very good questions here. We're not going to be able to get to all of them, so I apologize if I don't select your question. So I'm just going to take a shot at it here. There's one that's interesting. Has there been an associated decrease in nonviolent crime with the institution of these programs that are targeting violence?
So here's what we think. So some of these effects are very difficult to tease out in a rigorous, social, scientific, methodologically sound way. So we do not have really concrete evidence on that question. And therefore, I'm going to answer a different question.
Speaker's prerogative.
And that is that this is a framework, not a program, not something that's even specifically about serious violent crime. It started there, and that is still my and everybody's most serious focus. But increasingly we are realizing that it is a way of thinking about the work, and in that it is a way of thinking about resetting the relationships between communities, offenders, and law enforcement. It's bigger than Operation Ceasefire or anything like that. The first version of the first realization was the logic began to be mapped onto different substantive problems. So it began with people killing each other. The next step was to shut down what we call overt drug markets. As I've suggested here a couple of times, there's dope in a lot of places that aren't dangerous. And my interest in dope is that when the way in which it is sold is dangerous and creates toxic public spaces, we want to do something about that. I will say to people in communities, and everybody gets this and everybody kind of loves it, I want people selling dope the way they sell dope here. I do. Nobody's getting shot here, right? That's what we want. Those communities have every right to the same conditions that we take for granted, right? So it turns out that same things apply. If you look at one of these open drug markets, it is a handful of people who actually stand out on a corner and sell drugs to passing cars or operate a crack house. You can engage with them in exactly the same way. You can make those overt markets go away forever. NYPD has figured out that if you look at people with multiple robbery priors and go out and visit them and talk to their mothers and talk to their families and say, young man, I know what you're doing. I want to make sure your mother knows what you're doing. If you keep doing this, you're going to get very special attention from the prosecutor, and we want you to know that ahead of time. And we'd actually really like to help you and your family, so let's talk about how we can do that. They're getting 80-plus reductions in robberies from those populations. It's working with drunk driving. There's something called 24/7, which is if you are a recidivist drunk driver, you get called to a day reporting center pretty much every day. And if you don't blow negative, or I guess you can't be negative drinking and you end up blow equal or something like that. But if you fail to blow positive, you get to go home. And if you blow positive, you get a day of jail. And not only are they getting almost complete compliance with this, they're finding that that compliance maintains at about 50% after people are no longer on the program. They have figured out how to govern their behavior. So what we're finding is this is a way of thinking about doing public safety that you can map on to lots and lots of different situations, and the record on that is pretty promising so far.
Okay. Here's another question. How can social workers use this information when working directly with children, adolescents, and young adults doing prevention and intervention work?
First, God bless you, because I can't really think of anything harder to do. And I don't have a thing to say about mainstream social work practice. What I do have something to say about is something not to do. And it's exactly parallel to what we counsel, say, line police officers. Once again, when we're talking about this stuff, there are very, very few people who are at the center of the mix. There are very few people who are even at high risk of shooting another human being or standing on a corner and selling drugs and so on and so forth. One of the things that this leads one to is that, as an empirical fact, there are infinitely more of us than there are of them. I mean, like 99.9% more of us than there are of them in an average city. Which then leads us to the question, so why are they getting away with it? Right? And one of the answers is that they are very good at existing in the cracks in our solidarity. And lots and lots of people focus on these issues. And they tend to come from different perspectives, and they tend to not trust each other and not respect each other, or often worse. So the cops look at the social workers and think they're naive thug huggers, and they look at these people who, you know, we know are out there shooting people, and they call them their clients. and the social workers look at these guys, and these guys have all these horrible stories, many of which are true, about being abused on the street by the cops, and they look at the cops and think, okay, the real thugs are over there in uniform. And just to underscore what I had up here for a while, neither side will stand shoulder to shoulder and look at these guys and say what is really common sense, which is you should not do wrong things. You know, the fact that you've done wrong things does not make you an evil human being, and we're not going to banish you from society. Of course we want you back. Of course we'll help get you back. But we're not going to pretend that only one side of the spectrum is right. We are not going to pretend that you are just a poor, misunderstood victim, and we are not going to pretend that you are just a super predatory psychopath. What we want is people, no matter where they stand on this, and we're drawn to helping or we're drawn to consequences. It's the way we're built. We don't study the evidence and say, I think facilitative interventions are the better source to community health, so I become a social worker. You're a social worker because you like kids, and cops are the same way in their own way. But what we ought to understand is that if we don't get a consistent basic relationship with these guys right, they will run through the hole that we create. And so on the social work side, in addition to what you all already do, make sure that you say to people who are at high risk for shooting other people, don't do that. No matter what else is going on, no matter what help you need, no matter what we're going to do together, there is no excuse for the violence, and it is not going to happen here. And if they hear that from everybody, it punches through. Just like the cops should say, I'd actually rather help you get help than hit you in the head or stick you in a box.
And what role do you think schools can play to help in this process?
They could show up. That'd be nice. And I'm not talking about this place. But one of the perennial frustrations in doing this work is that the normal public schools are totally missing in action. And I am absolutely not going to put my friend Kelly on the spot on this and ask him whether this is true in Salinas. But what we find most places is you can get almost everybody to the table. And the world of official education wants nothing to do with this. They pretend that what goes on outside their walls has nothing to do with what goes on inside. They will not even share information about what goes on inside. You can have an argument in the school that if we knew about it on the outside, we would know was likely to go to a shooting beef and we could get in the middle of it. But nobody will say anything. I've worked in situations in which people were brawling in the school, ran outside, some guy got knifed on the sidewalk, and the schools didn't report it because it didn't happen on their grounds. It's just not at all unusual. And it would be really, really nice if sort of mainstream formal education would open up to this kind of thing a little bit.
Excellent. Well, it's I'm hopeful that the approach of developing these partnerships, you know, that focus on collective impact, can start breaking down some of those silos.
Yeah.
So let me follow up on that question with my last question, which is, what do you think the university can do explicitly to help in this process?
I think there's an awful lot. So in no particular order, the 1% need to know that they have options. Most of almost everybody out there is not an innately evil person. And this is not to be naive about any of this. The things they do are as horrific as they are, and they in fact are. But it doesn't mean that they are, you know, psychopaths and super predators. And when you get them on their own and get to know them, they will break your heart because they never had a chance. they have internalized this awful sense of damage and worthlessness, many of them. And, you know, the reason that these guys in this last call-in hung around and talked to the mayor and talked to the cops and talked to the feds was because they were treated with respect and they were welcomed. And it actually doesn't take much, a lot, to start drawing people back in. They need different communities to be part of. You know, one of my very good friends says, you know, on the street code and all that stuff is as hollow and destructive as it really is, but it has tremendous magnetism. You know, and when you're running with people who say, I'll take a bullet for you and I'll die for you and I'll always have your back and I'll always be with you, having, again, you know, some program person say, I'll do an intake assessment and I'll provide you with case management, it doesn't begin to get through, right? So, you know, schools are communities. You meet new people, you have new relationships, people model new stuff for you. So drawing people into a new community is probably more important than service provision is. So all of that, any way of engaging people, not just in education, but kind of in a new set of relationships, really important. Universities should create opportunities and really push students toward them to get out into these communities. You can hold your breath and walk to these neighborhoods in most of our cities, and still most people who don't live there or work in them will never see them. They are not what we think they are. They are not our stereotypes. The people there do not behave the way our cartoon visions of them would have it. They will make you welcome if you treat them with respect. They will talk to you. And, you know, I have my friends who are up in arms about oppression in Tibet, and God bless them for that. I want them paying attention to the same stuff that is going on right here. And so ways of actually doing real research, all that sort of stuff in these communities is hugely important. I don't know if anybody here is doing what is increasingly called inside out. So you have, unfortunately, a lot of California penal institutions, and there's a structure now that will help you build classes that will be taught in the institution and which will include both inmates and outside students. And they are wonderful experiences, and the sad fact is the people who benefit them from them the most are the outside students, because they get to see people and engage with them in ways that most of them will never, ever do otherwise. And you cannot actually engage with these people and leave with the same ideas of them you had when you went in. So that's very valuable. And then all of these sort of new problem-oriented approaches benefit from applied research. Some of it very, very, very simple research. But again, Kelly's been through this a couple of times now. As straightforward as it is for somebody with research experience to come into a city and say, you have this many groups and they're, you know, they're embedded in these relationships and the nature of their violent encounters is as such, and hear how that's mapped onto neighborhoods and time and place and all that kind of thing. Anybody with a decent methods background can do this in their sleep, but most practitioners don't have the training or the time to do it. And what we call action research, right? This is a real tradition in social science. It's engaged, problem-oriented partnership research is badly needed in all of these important public policy areas.
Well, it's good to point out that our university has a tradition of doing that kind of applied research. So
great.
This is an area that I'm looking forward to us doing more in. So thank you very much. It's been fantastic.